And good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to have back on the program once again, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We have been doing this program for a long time. It comes up on a Monday, and it is an opportunity for you to ask home maintenance questions. Maybe you have a problem, and you're not sure how to deal with it, or you're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling. Something needs to be fixed. You want to make your home more energy efficient, more comfortable, whatever. Scott knows a lot about all the various pieces and parts of the single-family home. So you can have questions about siding, roofing, gutters, basements, attic, windows. I'll stop. You get the idea. Any and all of those kind of questions are certainly fine. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email if you want to do that. will-talk@illinois.edu. That is the email. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David. Always great to come out here and talk with people and see what we've got out. I just did a quick trip out to North Carolina, and it was kind of interesting as I'm driving around looking at all the different types of construction. Really, it's hard to believe how many different styles there are just going across the country. You know, you get out there and the houses are a little bit older than what we've got in this area, and I'm thinking, well, wow, that's a slate roof, and it's still in good shape. And things that we don't usually see here on a regular basis. So it was a fun trip looking at houses and such.
Okay. Well, again, questions welcome. We got somebody lined up and ready to go. It's been a little odd winter in the sense that it's been warmer than average. So I don't know that if it's testing to the extremes, our furnaces and our insulation and so forth. Still cold enough so that I'm sure that people want to be warm and comfortable.
Well, actually, with the mild temperatures, I'm sure that everybody is saving a little bit on their gas usage. Of course, the gas prices decided to go up, so not necessarily saving any money at it, but at least our usage is down. So we were I'm going to call it a green winter. We didn't use as much fuel keeping our houses warm because we are, of course, hopefully everybody is insulated for the normal temperatures or normal winters, which, of course, didn't happen this year.
Yeah, okay. Well, we got somebody ready to go here, someone who has a question in Urbana, and we'll go right to them. This is line number one. Hi.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask this. We built a house about 5 years ago, and there are some willow trees on it. I was looking at one of the willows, and it's right next to the water main. And I've heard stories about willows seeking out water mains and cracking them and stuff. Should I cut that tree down, do you think?
Well, you say the house is 15 years old?
Five
years old? Okay. Probably not going to be a big issue. Willow trees can seek out water mains. However, that's generally ones that are leaking. And the newer stuff that is used today, the plastic and polymer style water lines, really don't have the problem that the old steel lines and such did, or even the old copper lines. So I would say that you're probably safe.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ideally, the tree should have been planted a little bit farther off the line. But, you know, with the water lines we've got now, I don't think we've got the seepage, so therefore we don't have the root activity.
All right. Thank you very
much. Very good. Well, other questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe that would raise a question about planting trees, particularly close to foundations. That can be a problem. What's the recommendation?
Well, you have to look at what the size of the plant, tree, bush, whatever it is you're doing, in its full growth. When you buy them at the store or the landscaper brings them out, and they're nice and little and cute, and you know, you get this little evergreen that's 15 inches in diameter, but you have to stop and think, this thing's going to get 5 or 6 feet in diameter, so you can't plant it 3 feet from the house. It's going to be up against the siding. You need to plant it 6 or 7 feet away from the house, and you're looking at it going, wow, this tree just looks out of place next to the house. Well, in 10 years, when it has started to mature, it's not going to be out of place. And we run into this regularly. It's either that or you put them up where you want, put them where you want them, they look good now, and dig them up later and move them. But somehow or another, nobody ever gets around to moving them back out. So we do have some issues where we get a lot of plants too close to houses. It's a good idea to keep them trimmed well back away from the siding and get some air moving around the siding. generally speaking, your siding is not airtight. What's behind the siding is your technical weather barrier. The siding is to help protect that weather barrier from UVs, rainstorms, debris, wind, things like that. But your really airtight barrier is behind that siding. And if we've got trees and shrubs built up next to it, we can end up with moisture staying next to that siding, get mildew, moss, things like that growing on the siding. So, yeah, ideally they need to be planted farther out. Some trees, particularly a pine tree type, something with needles instead of leaves, they have a very shallow, very wide root base. And so you need to get those a little bit farther away from the house to give them room for the roots to not get entangled in the foundation and any wiring for pole lights, water lines, things like that.
Yeah, okay. Another caller here, also Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. This reminds me of a question I've had for a while. I've got probably about a 60-year-old house. Maybe it's a little older than that. And, of course, from time to time I get advertisements telling me that I should buy water line insurance. And I believe I'm responsible from the point of the meter. Is that right?
Actually, no. There's the meter is usually in the house.
It is.
You are not responsible for paying for the water from the meter back, but you are mm-hmm. responsible for the water line from that meter out to the T at the main water line. That is considered to be a property owner where they tee off.
Okay.
So if there's a leak out there, then it's before the meter. You're not paying for the water usage, but you do have to pay for the repairs between the water meter and the main. And there are some areas that were built with pipes that have had some problems, particularly old steel pipes. The water line insurance is one of those things where on older homes, it almost makes sense. On newer homes, it's probably not worthwhile at this point in time. How many trees you've got planted in the area, whether or not your driveway goes over the top of it, that we can create some pressure or some settling issues. Things like that all depend on whether or not that's actually a good idea. It can get quite expensive if your water line goes out through the middle of the front of the property or even out the back of the property where you've got a lot of landscaping. You've got to get somebody to come in there and dig down 4 feet with a backhoe and replace it. It can get quite expensive. So, and the insurance itself is relatively inexpensive. I just kind of look at the individual houses and look and say, oh, here is where your water lines run. We've got nothing there, or we've got a driveway there, or we've got a large tree in that area. And kind of go from there and make a judgment call whether or not you're in a position where you can gamble without having the insurance or whether you think the $3 a month is worth it.
Yeah, it's probably 40 or 50 feet to the point of intersection, and it does not, the driveway does not go over it.
Okay. Well, go downstairs and look at wherever your water meter is and look at the water line coming through the foundation. And see what kind of material it is. If it looks like it's a copper, probably not going to be a big issue for the most part because it's pretty durable. It's a little bit flexible, so it tends to move. If it's a steel line, then you may want to consider getting the insurance because eventually you could have some problems with it.
Yeah, well, that's good advice. I often wondered about it. The advertising seems almost scare tactics, but
well, yes, I well, let's face it. If they can get everybody to pay them an extra $3 a month for this insurance, then it makes their overhead look a little bit better.
Would 60, 70 years old fall into the older group, or does that actually go back to?
Well, you're going to be, you're going to be pretty much a borderline on that one. And so it's old enough to where it's very likely that you could have some older steel pipes. That's why I recommend going and actually look at the meter and see what type of pipe actually comes through the wall.
Well, thanks so much, and I'll take a look at it.
Okay, very
Bye.
Good.
Bye.
Let's go on. And I think we'll be talking next with someone in Urbana, I think, on our line number two. Hello? Caller there? We'll check. How about that? Now, caller on line two. Okay. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. If you want to send us an email, you can do that too. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest this morning is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do this program every month, and it's here to give you an opportunity to ask home maintenance questions. So if there's something on your mind, you got some kind of a problem, you can give us a call. With anything else that you wanted to add on to the water question? I guess I've sort of had that question myself because I've gotten the same mailings from them, and I'm thinking, well, okay, I'm here 22 years and it seems to be going okay. Mm-hmm. Is that really an issue?
Well, when it comes to insurance, it's a gamble. Okay, they're saying we're going to bet you $3 a month that we're not going to have to do any repairs, and you're saying, well, I think it's worth $3 a month to make sure that I don't have to pay something later down the road if something does happen. Mm-hmm. So if we were playing at the riverboat, we'd be checking what the odds were. And so that's basically what I was asking or questions and looking into is what are the odds that there could be something wrong? There's no way to guarantee one way or another. I mean, a water line put in 3 weeks ago could burst, sure, or a water line put in 50 years ago or 75 years ago may last another 30 years. So there's no cut and dry, here's what's going to happen. You just kind of look at the variables. If you've got a water line and it's running in an area where we've got older, mature, larger trees, there's a possibility. If it's made out of a flexible plastic line, which most of the new ones are, and a very little chance of something happening. Now, you go out there and start digging and putting in new trees or putting in a pole and putting up a fence over the top of it and manage to nick that line, that's a different story. There's no cut and dry, oh, yes, you need to get the insurance, but there are several houses that wouldn't be a bad idea. And as we start getting into that 50- or 60-year-old houses built in the 50s, houses built in the 60s, it's probably not a bad idea, particularly if you're in a position where a water line breaks and you've got to come up with $1,800 or $3,000 to fix it, and that's going to put a significant financial burden in it in your monthly bills, then it might not be something you would want to take lightly. Yeah. Just kind of look over it and see what's there. But I will agree they do tend to use the scare tactics, which I am never real fond of on that one.
Okay. Back, we do have this person, I think, in Urbana on line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
We put an addition on our home about 22 years ago, and almost from the beginning, we have a mold problem on the exterior siding that develops every summer.
All right. Just little black spots?
Yes.
Or is it actually turning green?
No, it's black.
All right. A wood siding, then, I'm going to assume.
I'm sorry?
A wood siding?
Yes, wood siding.
Okay. Part of that is we just don't have the additives in the paint that we used to have. It used to be when we could put a lead-based paint on there, we didn't have to worry about things like that. Of course, you didn't want to eat the paint chips afterwards. So some of the algicides, some of the mildew-resistant chemicals they're putting in the paint aren't as good. It kind of depends on whether or not we got a good base coat of primer on it before they painted it as to how susceptible it is to the spotting. Usually washing it off and getting a good algicide, a good plant growth killer over the top of it, or you make sure you get a paint that has an additive in there to eliminate algae. Again, cutting trees back so we get some air movement past it. I'm going to assume that the addition is going to be on the north side of the house, so we're not getting the sunlight, which...
No, actually, the worst mold is on the east side, and it's totally open to the sun. And there's no planting around it at all.
That is a little unusual. Usually if we get mold and mildew, it's on the north side where we don't get the sun heating up the siding enough, so we end up with some moisture condensation on there. If you've got mold on a wall that has sunlight and has a good exposure like that, we may be looking at another problem of moisture in the wall. Check to make sure the addition has a proper vapor barrier in the crawl space underneath it. Something that would be creating a high humidity in that particular room, which would then, of course, come through the walls and try and grow a little bit of mold or mildew.
Okay.
Other than that, when you paint it next time, make sure, you know, go to a professional paint store and say, hey, look, I've got a problem wall. What can we put in the paint? Because they do have some good chemicals to help reduce the growth inside or alongside the siding and inside the paint.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. And that is something that you could get then blended into the paint when you buy
exactly,
it.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. Champagne, next. Line number one. Hello?
Yes. Like I suppose most people, I've received a number of those things in the mail about waterline insurance. And since I live in a house that's 50-some years old, I've taken the trouble to read the fine print on them. And my decision after doing that was that I didn't think I wanted any part of their, quote, insurance, unquote. This was a while ago, but some of the things I remember are that it isn't just that when you have a problem, you get it fixed and then the insurance pays some of it. You agree in advance to take whatever person they send to fix the problem, and you agree in advance to do whatever that those people say that you should do. And the ones that I checked, they don't restore the situation to the way it was before. All they do is dig up the pipe and replace the pipe and cover it up. And all things considered, I didn't think that was a good deal, that I would prefer to just wait and take my chances. And so my advice to anyone who's thinking about this is to be sure to get the fine print, read it carefully, and make a decision on the basis of that.
That's always a good idea. And again, I'm sure what they're doing is they're saying, hey, we don't want somebody, we're not going to pay just anybody to fix it. We want, the insurance company is looking at it as, hey, we want somebody who is used to doing the water lines. And those guys are, well, we're not going to quote stuff on doing a little repair here. And we're going to figure out how many feet it is from the T to the water line, and we're going to replace the entire line so we don't have to do this again. So, yes, there probably is some wording in the insurance for that, and it is something also to take into consideration. So I can't give you a blanket and say, oh, everybody should get this insurance or nobody should get this insurance. It kind of goes from individual basis, and I will say I don't have it. That's about as far as I can go with that.
Well, yes, as I say, the whole thing looks a little scammy to me, everyone that I've seen. I don't have any basis for that other than what I've already said, but I think anyone should look at it with a very careful eye. And I'm curious why it is that the people who provide homeowners insurance don't provide an option for this. It seemed a logical thing to do.
My guess is that if you were to talk to your homeowner agent, there is something in there for water and supply lines and such, but it would be a rider on the policy. And I appreciate you bringing that up.
All right, thank you. Again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You have a question for our guest, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. We do have an email here from someone who says that they're looking at replacing their roof before too long, and they have some questions about metal standing seam roofing. They say they know that that's more expensive than asphalt, but how much more? Are there qualified installers in this area? And generally, they'd like to know how you feel about it.
Well, the steel siding is definitely something that's becoming more and more popular in the area. They're doing a really good job of advertising it. It is not a cure-all. There are still some problems with steel siding, the biggest one being condensation issues. And I'll be honest, I haven't had time to do the research to find out exactly how they're addressing some of these issues. So I would have to say I'm not a complete expert on it. Steel siding is a good long-term durable siding. You see it on a lot of farm buildings and such. Depending on the coating they put on it, whether it's a powder coating, whether it's an elastomeric coating that they bond to the steel. Steel obviously rusts, so it has to have something over the top of it to prevent that. And when it's installed, we got to make sure that it doesn't get scratched and scuffed so that we rust at the scratches where it goes through the surface coating. But also, we end up with the steel is effectively a vapor barrier, and it gets quite cold. So if you've got humidity in the house, it wants to come up and condense on the bottom side of the steel siding and wants to drip down. Hmm. I know when they tried doing steel siding back in, late 50s, early 60s, some of the all-steel houses that we have here in Champaign-Urbana, they actually put a gutter inside the attic area to catch the water that was running down the roofing because of the amount of condensation. Now, hopefully the houses nowadays, we've got a lot better vapor barrier between the house and the attic area, so we're not getting as much moisture into the attic. But I still see a lot of wood siding or a lot of wood sheathing in attics that has a lot of mold and mildew, which would tell me we are getting some condensation issues in attics with wood framing. So therefore, it would transfer that we might have condensation issues with houses that have steel siding. And that steel siding, I've been in a lot of old metal huts that first time it gets cold out, it's raining inside. So there are some things to take into account. The steel siding is not a 100%, again, a blanket. Hey, that's the best stuff. It is a good long durable siding, and depending on the coating they put on it and how scratch resistant it is and how it's installed. But I'm going to do some more research. Hopefully maybe next month when we do this, because it has come up now two or three times, I'll have a little bit better idea of just what they're doing to help control that condensation issue.
So just on the durability issue or the longevity issue, for if there are asphalt shingles that are designed to, that they say will go 30 years, a metal roof, assuming that it's protected so that it doesn't rust, how
it could get double that life, or, you know, we could get 50, 60 years out of one if it's done correctly and has a good coating on it. But if you drive through the countryside, you'll see some of these metal buildings that have different shades of paint as somebody's tried to extend their life. Whatever surface coat was put on at the time the farm buildings were installed has worn off, and they've started to get a little rust, and you try and put over a good coating over the top of it. So like I say, I'll have to do a little bit more insight into just exactly what they're doing to help make sure we don't have condensation issues in the attic and what kind of durability they've got on their exterior finish for the siding.
Okay. We have other callers. Urbana up again, line number one.
Yes.
Hello. Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I have two questions about radon. The first question is, we live in Urbana near the corner of Race and Pennsylvania. Has it come to your attention that there are radar problems in this area? And the second question is, we received as a gift a radon detector that we were supposed to let stand for, I don't know, 30 days or something, and then send it back to be tested. And we sort of forgot about it, and it's been there now for a little over a year. And Oh, 2 years, actually. And I wonder if it's still good, if we could send it in, or should we get another tester and start over again?
Well, first of all, radon is very difficult to predict. It's coming from decomposing rock underground, effectively. And
decomposing what?
Rock, granite.
Rock. Okay.
And some areas of this, Champaign County, have a lot of rock. Other areas have a lot of clay. Other areas have a little bit of sand. So, and, you know, you could have a high radon content at one house and the house next door have almost zero. So it's, there's no blanket that says, okay, hey, this area is low, this area is high. I will say that most of Champaign County does fall right in the area between about 3.0 to about a 7.0, and 4 being, of course, the area of concern, if you want to get right down to it, from the EPA. If you were to go with the NCRP, National Committee for Radon Prevention, it's closer to 10. So I'm not going to panic at a 7, but it's something that probably ought to be looked into, particularly if you don't go in or out. The radon stats, as I've mentioned on the program before, pretty much say that if you're in the house for more than 22 hours a day, for more than 362 days a year, then these stats are pertinent to your situation. However, if you go out of the house, open windows and doors, work 8 hours a day, things like that, then their stats are not as critical. It's just, anybody that's really good with numbers can make a set of stats look their direction. So I think that's pretty much what the EPA has done. They said, oh, my gosh, it's a problem if it's over 4. Well, my guess is if it's under 10, you're probably in pretty good shape, considering the EPA says, hey, if it's between 4 and 10, you should do something about it in the next 7 to 10 years. So if they're not too terribly worried about it at the low levels, I don't get too worried. But it's still a good idea to check it.
What about the thing we have had that tester for 2 years now?
Is it, well, the valid tester should have the name of the lab that you would mail it to. And the only thing I can say on 2 year, if you've left it there for 2 years when it was intended for 30 days, I would contact the lab before mailing it in. My guess is they will still be able to read it.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think it's going to be a problem. It's considered a long-term detector, and they want a minimum of 30 days. Usually most people will send it in right around that period. But since there is a mailing address and a name that you would have to mail this unit into, I would contact them first and see whether or not it is still valid.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And I guess then gives us the opportunity to make the point, and we've done this too, that there may be people who will sell you a short-term detector that they'd say, well, you can have this on for 3 days or a week or whatever. And your advice always has been, no, that's not long enough. Really, you need to put it in and leave it for a month.
This is where you get me in trouble with the home inspectors that make their money by saying, hey, you have to do a test when you buy a house. You're absolutely correct, David. A 3-day or 24-hour radon test is accurate for that period of time. However, it may not reflect the actual radon level or content in your house for the yearly average that the EPA bases their numbers on. So if you're going to get an accurate idea of what the radon level is, you really need to put something in that's going to last more than 30 days. Matter of fact, the EPA says if you fail a short-term test, you should do a long-term test. The local practices in our area, if you fail a short-term test, to put in a radon system. That is not correct. The EPA states if you fail a short-term test, you should put in a long-term test. Since this is a colorless, odorless, invisible gas coming up out of the ground, it is directly affected by barometric pressure. If you have bright, sunny days with high barometric pressure, you're going to have less gas coming out of the ground, less getting into the house. If you have dreary, stormy days, nice dark clouds, rain, we're going to have a low barometric pressure. We are going to have more gas coming up out of the ground. So I have put in testers, electronic testers, and it was a very good weather predictor. You could watch and you could see as the fronts would go in and out and the high pressures would come in and it get sunny, and you could watch the radon level on this chart just going up and down. So when you do a radon test, you're supposed to keep all the windows and doors closed on a short term. You're supposed to keep all the windows and doors closed, and it can give you a very accurate reading for that short-term 24-hour, 48-hour, 72, however long you put it in there. But do not panic. That is not necessarily an indication of the yearly average. Now, if it comes back at 2 or 3, yeah, I probably wouldn't put in the long-term. If it comes back between, say, 4 and 8, I would probably do a long-term. If it's going to be above 8, my guess is you're going to have to put in a radon system of some sort.
Okay. We're talking this morning with Scott Spies. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. We'll talk some more after a very short break and take some more calls. This is Focus.
Hi, this is WILL station manager Bob Culkeen. Thank you to the 332 listeners who made a pledge of support during our February pledge drive. You raised more than $42,000 for WILL, your local public radio station. And thanks to the Common Ground Food Co-op, their partnership provides generous support to both WILL and the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. This local partnership provides over 2,600 meals to local families.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics for you every week. In hour two today, we'll talk with Catherine Boo. She's a staff writer with The New Yorker magazine, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. We will talk about her new book, Behind the Beautiful Forever's Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. It's all about life in a slum that exists right beside the international airport in Mumbai, India, a place where 3,000 people live, and it's about their daily lives and what they're like. Extremely poor people living in India. On the program tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about the promise and peril of the Arab Revolution with Marwan Bishara. He's a senior political analyst with Al Jazeera English. Also tomorrow, we'll have another candidate in that will be competing in the Illinois March primary. And our guest will be Shane Cultra. He is an Illinois state senator. He is competing for his party's, and he's a Republican, he's competing for his party spot on the ballot in the new 53rd Senate district. He's currently a member of the Illinois State Senate. So you'll be able to talk with him about whatever's on your mind. Again, we're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. You can find us online at will.illinois.edu. You can check out the schedule there. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. This is Focus, our morning talk show. Our guest is Scott Spies with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program once a month on a Monday, and we talk about home maintenance. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Champagne is next, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. How about one more call about waterline insurance?
Sure.
I recently had that very thing done last summer, probably 8 or 9 months ago. And everything went fine, except I happened to be here when they were finishing the work, and they put a 6x6 tarpaulin, two of them down, to put one of them for the topsoil and another one for the clay underneath. Well, when they got done putting the clay back, they were burying that 6x6 tarpaulin in the hole. And I happened to be looking out, and I saw it, and, man, that really disturbed me, because the way we found, of course, the leak previously was that it was directly above the water pool was directly above where the leak was, and that made it pretty simple. But if they were going to bury this tarpaulin in there, and there was a leak someplace close or wherever, that would completely destroy any knowledge of where that leak might be around there. And I just couldn't understand why this contractor, because I never did find out the name of the contractor. They didn't have a name on their truck. But anyway, the leak has not returned, but I guess the point I'm trying to make here is you not only have to read the fine print, but you probably have to watch the people that do the work when and if you ever need to get it done. And this was my first year under the program, so my $60 investment in the insurance was well worth it. But I'm a little bit leery of the people that they send out to do the work.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. Unfortunately, that it seems to be with any home repair, you kind of have to keep an eye on what's going on, because they're not always doing what you think they're doing. Although I have run into some instances where somebody has called me and said, I don't think my contractor's doing right, and I had to assure them that, yes, that was the way to do it. But yeah, it's always a good idea to keep an eye on these things. I, too, would be a little concerned in burying the plastic cover. Hopefully the new line that they put in, of course, is not corrosive. In other words, we don't have a steel pipe that'll rust. They put in a plastic line that should last for 100 years so that a plastic is not going to bother it. But if we had some remnants of an old metal line and we then put a plastic vapor barrier around it where water cannot leach away from it, it could create another rust problem. So that was a good idea for you to come back and take a look and catch that.
Well, they didn't replace the line. They just repaired the leak, and it was a 2-inch copper line. It was a very expensive line, but they did not replace anything beyond or just repairing that hole.
Okay.
So that was why my concern in terms of burying the tarpaulin.
And that is exactly why I can't say everybody should run out and buy the insurance, but it's not a bad idea for everybody to at least take a look at it if they've got something that could possibly be an issue like that.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for calling in.
All right. Well, thanks. We have a couple of questions here came in by email. Let me ask you this. First of all, we have someone here who doing some, I guess, some remodeling. The original concrete slab, this dates from 1978, extending outside from our walkout basement, is going to be used as a floor for a 220-square-foot office. What vapor barrier should I put between the concrete and the carpet? Person says, I've looked at plastic tarp, sprays, and all-in-one ideas like DryCore. However, DryCore seems really expensive. Right now I'm leaning towards a floating OSB floor with carpet tiles, but I don't know if anything should go below the OSB.
If you're going to put OSB down on concrete, you're going to want some type of vapor barrier between the two, because the concrete will be cooler. And being the coldest spot in a room, it can create some condensation issue, which, of course, the OSB would then suck up or wick up and create an issue with the bonding agents in the OSB. So, yes, there does need to be some type of vapor barrier. One of the things that I would also be looking at probably at least as heavily as a vapor barrier, if not more, and that would be edge insulation. When you build a slab for a patio or something, we do not insulate the edge from the soils, and we can get a lot of heat loss out through the edges of the concrete slab. So depending on how close to the soil surface this slab is going to be, digging around it and putting some type of insulation so that we're not radiating heat out towards the soil from the concrete slab can make a big difference on how cold it is and how much condensation it gets. Theoretically, once everything is built, we've got the addition on top of it, that concrete slab should stay about 55 degrees. And 55 degrees is relatively comfortable. But if we've got some edge of it that is near the frost line, somewhere 8 to 10 inches below, we could lose a little bit of heat. We could end up with a cold edge on the concrete, and that cold edge would then create, I've seen it have frost, but it's cold enough to get some condensation. It gets down to, you know, outside temperatures or near outside temperatures. So we end up with this really cold band around our new room that gets a lot of mold and mildew on the walls.
Mm-hmm.
So a vapor barrier over the concrete before you put a wood substrate, and also some type of edge insulation. If he's going to be buried, you know, we said the caller or the email indicates a walkout basement. If the slab is going to be, you know, 4 feet under grade when they get done, then it's not as critical. But if it's going to be close to the grade surface, definitely a vapor barrier and definitely some type of edge insulation.
Okay, hope that that helps. Here's another one. I live in a 100-year-old home, more than 100 years old. The furnace is, of course, newer, but my question is about these metal trays, half-inch high sides that fit over the vents below the floor registers, all of which I assume have been here 50-plus years. What are these about? Just to keep things from falling down in or some other function? They can cover half of the vent, possibly obstructing hot air coming from the furnace. So I've wondered about removing them or using them for whatever else their function is.
All right. Not sure that I'm familiar with metal trays inside the ducts. I know that a lot of times the return air, if you look down through a return grill, you will see a metal pan, and that is that they actually didn't run ductwork for return air. They used the space between the joists as a return duct. So you'd have your floor joist, your 2x8 or 2x10, and then they would just tack a tin panel on the bottom of it and run that tin panel all the way back to wherever we're pulling our return air, and basically use that joist space as duct rather than install an actual duct to the register. But some type of pan in there I'm not really familiar with. I know back when we had hot water heat in older homes, that people would put a pan on the radiator to get a little moisture in. I wonder if it's somebody was trying to add a little moisture or humidity by putting a pan in the register and then pouring a glass of water in it. So as the heat, warm air was blowing on it, it would tend to evaporate and keep the humidity level up in the house. On older homes with very little insulation and with a lot of air loss, they do dry out in the winter, and so that is one way of adding some humidity. So I will have to say that I'm a little intrigued by the idea of metal pans, and I'd be interested in knowing a little bit more about it and what it looks like before I can make an accurate assessment of what it's actually doing.
Okay, so you think it actually could be a humidification device?
I have seen that in the past where somebody has put something over a register or in a register where they could pour a glass of water, and as the air blows by, it picks up the moisture, evaporates the water in the pan, and keeps humidity level in the house higher. As we've discussed earlier, in earlier versions of our show here, when you have a house that has a lot of air loss outside, once the temperature drops, the humidity level goes extremely low. You know, it gets below 32 degrees outside, and most of the water in the air freezes and falls out one way or another. So if you've got a lot of airflow through the house, say 25 or 30 air exchanges in a 24-hour period, the house is going to dry out because of how dry the outside air is. So you're going to need to add some moisture to the house. Now, ideally, what we do is weather strip the house, insulate the house, reduce those air exchanges, the amount of air leaks in the house, down to 5 or 6 or 7 or something that's more manageable. Mm-hmm. And then the normal moisture we put in with cooking, cleaning, showering, talking, things like that will all keep the moisture level in the house high enough. But on old, loose houses, yeah, we actually had to add a lot of water to them. And so it's very possible that somebody had something that they just put a little water there and help keep the humidity level up, keep the shock factor down. It's always exciting when you walk across carpet in the socks and reach out to pet the cat, and you get this little blue arc goes out there, and the cat doesn't talk to you for a week.
Cat doesn't enjoy it much either. Yeah, exactly. Well, we're here, and we have plenty of time for other questions. We have about 10, 12, 13 minutes left with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program every month. It's a Monday, and we take your questions on home care. So 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. When it's been, you know, some of the weather we've had has been warm enough, so certainly it's you can be outside and doing things outside. I don't know if people are actually walking around their house and kind of looking at things and looking for things to do. Probably still too cold to be painting. But, you know, what would you say at this point, people, you just say, if you got a nice, warm, sunny day, you want to be outside, go out, take a little walk around the house. What should people be looking at?
How damp the ground is next to the house. Is there a dry area next to the house, or is it appear that water's been collecting, you know, dripping from leaky gutters? As we had our first caller say something about mildew on the siding. Look in the soffit areas and stuff. Okay, is it dirty? Is it mildew? Have I got some moisture problems? Look around the edges of the windows. Is there a lot of gaps where air or water could get in, bugs? I really like to see, when I look at a house, and look at the siding at the bottom and find 3 to 4 inches of exposed foundation before we get to the soil level. This allows for air to get up in behind the siding so we don't have moisture problems. If your landscape mulch, your decorative landscape, or the soil or the grass is right up against the bottom of the siding, you might want to start saying, hey, maybe this spring we ought to do some regrading, re-landscaping, and see if we can't get that foundation exposed. At least, I believe the BOCA code says 4 to 6 inches of foundation should be showing up between the siding and the final grade. So when you're walking around this time of year and the plants are down because they haven't grown, we can actually see where that that foundation level is, and wonder if maybe we shouldn't do some regrading to help keep the air movement behind the siding to reduce moisture problems, mildew problems. I hate to use the word mold, but that does grow with excessive moisture or with areas that don't get good ventilation.
Okay. A couple of other callers here. They're both in Champaign. First is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I was calling to see, is there any way I could insulate? I have a tri-level house, and so I have my lower level is half below below ground.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to insulate it? Because that room stays really cold in the wintertime, and I didn't know if there's anything I could do to insulate it or make it more reasonable temperature down there.
Well, there's several different things that can be done. My guess is with a tri-level like that the heat on that lower level is probably coming in at the ceiling, which is the first thing that's going to make it a little bit more uncomfortable.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, most of the time on a tri-level, that heat comes in at the ceiling, and you put hot air in at the ceiling, it tends to stay there. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't move around much. You might try a small fan. Ceiling fans are the most popular, but they used to have what we call hassock fans, which are little footstool fans. If you put a fan in the room on the slowest speed you can, just move the air. It takes that warm air that's collecting at the ceiling and helps circulate it around. Your major furniture, your couch, beds, things like that, try not to put on the outside walls because the outside walls are going to be cooler. So if you sit in one of those areas or spend much time in those areas, you're going to feel cooler. The lower level is, I'm going to guess here, but with a tri-level, your lower level walls are probably about 3 feet of concrete and then a wood framing structure from there up.
Yeah, they're actually, well, they're cinder block. So
right, yeah, cinder block for the first 3 feet and then
And
then wood framing from there. And you can insulate that cinder block. Usually there's a paneling or a drywall over the top of that area. You can remove that, put in a foam insulation, and then put a drywall back over the top of it. If you use a foam insulation on concrete, make sure you put a fire-resistant material back over it, such as drywall. You can't put a foam insulation on concrete and then put back an inexpensive paneling. You have to have something that's fire-retardant. So if there's a fire, the foam doesn't put off toxic fumes from the heat. So,
okay, so are you saying between the drywall and the cinder block put the foam, or...
Yes.
Inside the cinder block.
No, inside the cinder block doesn't work. It's been tried, but because there's a continuous section of concrete through the block, it transfers heat through that through the block itself, even though you filled the cores. So your insulation will, either on the exterior where you excavate and dig out the yard, which is not recommended, a lot more work, or you come on the inside and put in a foam or a wrapped fiberglass. They do make some very specific fiberglass for masonry walls that has a vapor barrier on it so that the water can't get into it. So you could put either a foam or a wrapped fiberglass insulation on that cinder block wall, then put your wall covering back on, and that will help to some degree.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Very good. On to another caller. This is also somebody in Champaign. It's line number two. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've dealt with this before, but I still don't quite get it. But I have a situation in my kitchen where I have two windows. It's like a double window side by side. It's an old-style window with a storm window, one of those aluminum storm windows that goes up and down with the screen. And when it gets really cold, one of the windows gets condensation and frost and the other doesn't. So what would be the difference between the two?
All right. Is the condensation frost on the inside window where you can touch it from inside, or is the condensation frost
on
the storm window?
It's on the storm window.
All right. One of the windows is closed all the way and one of them's not. If you have moisture condensing on the storm window, you're getting your warm, humid air from your house through. So apparently the window that is fogging over or frosting over, that window is not shutting tightly. Either the weather stripping is missed.
So the inside window is not shutting tightly.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay,
your inside window is not sealing as well. And you also want to look at your storm window and make sure that there's some ventilation or something at the bottom. Usually I like to see a couple holes at the bottom or a little bit of air gap at the bottom of the aluminum storm window so that we can get some air movement between the two. But, yeah, usually when you get frost on one of the storm windows, it means your prime window, your interior window, is not sealed tightly.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Very good. And you do, though, want to make – there's you do want some ventilation. That is, you want a little bit of outside air to be able to get into that space in between the two windows, the one that faces the outside and one faces the inside.
The purpose of a storm window is to reduce active air movement past your prime window. Air is our insulator. When we put in fiberglass insulation, it's because it's light and fluffy and it holds air and air doesn't move through it. So this air can act as a preventative to our heat loss. Basically, heat does not transfer through dead airspace. So when we put in a double pane glass, what do? We put in two panes of glass. We remove all the air in between them. We don't have any air movement. When we put a storm window on a single pane glass, what we're doing is we're reducing the air that actually moves past that glass. We still want to ventilate it, and just as you said, we want to ventilate some outside air between the storm window and the prime window. If that ventilation does not take place, then we can end up with moisture issues. Generally, the moisture from the prime window gets out into that space, can't dissipate, so therefore we end up with a high humidity between those two, and the outside window will get cold, and you'll end up with frost on it. So, yes, some ventilation to that window. If somebody's caulked the storm window, that can happen. Or if the prime window doesn't seal, that can happen.
Yeah, and that's maybe, again, goes back to just reminding people that that little latch on old double-hung windows, that little latch that's on the top that you hook, that's not to keep people from breaking into your house. That's not going to do it. What that is it's to try to tighten up the seal so that you don't have that problem of
it's theft protection. If you close that, then you don't lose all your money out the window in heat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's stopping the big thief. The little thief, the guy that walks in and tries to steal a couple items off the counter, he's not the one we're worried about. It's the one that every day is taking dollars out from the heat loss. So, yeah, some type of latch or sealant on the window to help reduce that heat loss. I also wanted to address our tri-level one more time.
Oh, sure.
Just from the description, I knew that he was going to have heat in the ceiling. And anytime you put that hot air up there, it does tend to make the room a little less comfortable. One of the things that can be done, particularly for small areas like a bathroom or something, they do make heated floors where they have a mat that they can put underneath ceramic tile. We can heat a floor. Oftentimes a baseboard heater, electric baseboard heater in a bedroom for a lower level, some type of auxiliary heat will help. When you have a tri-level, in this area. Now, it works really well when we get down south. I was just in Augusta, Georgia the other day, and you know, it was 67 degrees on Friday, by the way. It's not so hard to heat those lower levels. But up here where it does get cold, the lower levels with the heat in the ceiling, it does get a little bit trickier to try and keep them as comfortable as the rest of the house. Of course, the easy thing would be to put on some wool socks so that your feet stay a little bit warmer and you'll be warmer in that area, but that's not the acceptable answer. So our caller may need to actually add some type of supplemental heat, not just insulation, because insulating will help reduce the heat loss, but if we haven't got any heat getting in there, it's not doing us much good.
That's, you sort of wonder why it is that, and maybe this is really the kind of thing that you can't really do with retrofitting that you need to do if you're starting from the ground up to build a place. But anyway, I was saying, you know, why it is that more people don't look at heating systems that heat floors, since that's where we live, and mm-hmm. that puts the heat where it is you are, and you know, having a warm, nice warm floor to walk around at, you're going to be a lot more comfortable than if your floor is cold.
We're kind of in the middle here. Central U.S., Central Illinois. Down south, they build houses more for cooling effects. Almost all the heating is in the ceiling because when you put in cold air, we want it to fall. We get farther up north, we get up the Minnesota area, we get into Dakotas, get up into our Canadian neighbors. Yeah, they put all the heat down in the floor. They look at putting in floor heat. Right here in central Illinois, right in the middle of things, we get a little of both. So sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and there's always going to be compromises. I mean, unless you're in an area that's always hot, so you always have to air conditioner on, or mm-hmm. it's always cold and you always have the heat on, it's kind of hard to develop a system that works both for equally well for both heating and cooling systems. Mm-hmm. So there's got to be some give and take. It's a compromise.
Okay. And given the kind of temperatures that we have had here, I'm still kind of thinking about painting. Just as a general kind of question, at what point is it okay to be doing outside painting in terms of temperature?
Well, the biggest problem with outside painting this time of year is it's going to get cold enough at night we can get condensation. The paint doesn't dry because mm-hmm. we're not getting mm-hmm. enough moisture. The humidity level's too high. So, yeah, I usually don't recommend painting anything underneath 60 degrees and usually try and be above 65 in the evenings because that evening temperature, that quick drop, will prevent the paint from curing properly.
Okay, so it'll probably be a little while here. Find something else to do.
I'm guessing you've got something you need to paint, David.
Oh well, at my house, yes, there's always something that I need to paint. Yes. And roofing, is it too cold to put a roof on now?
They have special roofing that is designed to be put on in cold weather that has a slightly different texture to the adhesive. So roofing can be done this time of year. Just make sure you use a cold weather shingle.
Okay. Well, getting down to the point, we just about have to finish up here. We don't. The markets are closed today, so we don't have market reports. And so in a couple of minutes here, we'll have the NPR news.
I was wondering how I was getting extra
minutes. Any last sort of thing you just might like to leave with folks?
Well, I'd like to thank, we just had our little plug for how many contributors we had the month of February. So I'd just like to thank all my listeners for tuning in and paying attention here to WILL and the wonderful program that David has with the Focus 580.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Scott Spies. He's from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month, always on a Monday. He'll be back next month. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.